to Tuned to Yesterday, featuring shows from radio's golden era. I'm your host, Mark Levonier, delivering an hour of true history. Later on, the program Inheritance, but first, the Hallmark Playhouse, with the story The Bride of Fortune, telling the story of the wife of Jefferson Davis. The CBS episode first heard on November 10th, 1949.
Remember, a Hallmark card when you carry enough to send the very best. Tonight from Hollywood, the makers of Hallmark greeting cards bring you Miss Irene Dunne in Harnett T. Kane's Bride of Fortune on the Hallmark Playhouse. Each week, Hallmark will bring you Hollywood's greatest stars in outstanding stories chosen by one of the world's best-known authors, the distinguished novelist, Mr. James Hilton.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is James Hilton. Tonight on our Hallmark Playhouse, we present a novel called Bride of Fortune by Harnett T. Kane. The Bride of Fortune Mr. Kane writes of became the wife of an American whose name is in every history book, Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederate States during those tragic years which only a very few people still alive can actually remember. Those of us who nowadays read about them can form our own opinion of the issues, and I dare say most of us have. But enough time has passed for all of us to read with understanding the story of a man whose personal character won for him the affection and loyalty of a charming and devoted woman. This is the story of Bride of Fortune which we tell tonight. And we are happy indeed to have with us in the starring role one of Hollywood's most distinguished actresses, Miss Irene Dunne. And now, a word about Hallmark cards from Frank Goss before we begin the first act of Bride of Fortune.
At Christmas, as on every memorable occasion, you'll take special pride in sending Hallmark cards. Because just as for hundreds of years, the word Hallmark has been the distinguishing symbol of quality, so today the Hallmark on the back of your greeting cards is your assurance of finest quality and perfect taste. It's a symbol of quality all who receive your cards will quickly recognize and realize you cared enough to send the very best. Now, Hallmark Playhouse, presenting Harnett T. Kane's Bride of Fortune, starring Miss Irene Dunne.
The carriage went slowly through the streets of Richmond. I sat beside my husband riding through the spring afternoon as we had ridden together so many times in the days long past. And as I rode, I found myself thinking, God heals all wounds. Already the grass grows green across the land, masking the soil where the steel went deep and the blood deeper. Already the lark and the sparrow, the grasshopper and the bee have taken repossession of the air that only recently shivered to the blast of gun and cannon. Already hands once clenched in mailed fists have reached out to one another in returning friendship. God heals all wounds. And then I looked at the weary, hopeless face of my husband beside me, and I thought, but how of your wounds? How of yours? And I touched his hand, and he turned towards me and smiled.
You're very quiet, Verena.
Jeff, I love you. I love you. He turned towards me and he smiled, and suddenly the years fell away from both of us. And no longer was it May in Richmond. It was Christmas in Vicksburg, and I was 17, and Jeff was in his early 30s. I was visiting his brother Joe's family for the holidays, and on Christmas Eve we stood alone on the veranda. I remember every word he said.
I've been married, you know. My wife died. It was some years ago.
I know. There's a man in Natchez, there's a sort of an understanding. Our family...
I'll probably stay right here and be a farmer, a cotton grower, the rest of my life. It isn't the most exciting life for a woman, but It's all right for a man.
But what about the political start you've made in these campaigns?
I don't know that I'm fitted for politics.
Well, you showed already what you can do. All you ever have to do is tell the people what you think and let them decide. And furthermore, plenty of women have found life very exciting and full and happy as wives of farmers.
Do you think you'd be happy as a farmer's wife?
Oh, Jeff, I think I'd be happy as yours.
Farina. Oh, Farina.
I'm sure I'd be happy as yours. Jeff, listen. It's Christmas.
Merry Christmas, darling.
Merry Christmas, darling.
The carriage went slowly through the streets of Richmond, and my husband turned towards me, and he smiled, and then he reached out and took my hand. My hand fitted his in the old glove-like way, and my heart was with its own. It lifted inside me just the way it lifted the day Jeff took me to Briarfield as his wife. It was spring at Briarfield. Jeff lifted me out of the carriage and he said to me,
"This has been my kingdom, and now it's yours."
And so I entered my kingdom. My kingdom's carpet was the rich green land, and my kingdom's walls was far-flung horizon. The ceiling of my kingdom was blue and gold by day and star-crested at night, and when I walked across it, the winds rested across my shoulders like silken scarves, and the voices of the river and the insect and the bird blended to a symphony. The treasure of my kingdom was in lavish display everywhere. Goldenrod waist high, lily pads the size of platters, and cotton lifting a regal fleecy head. That was my kingdom. Land and sky and horizon and my husband's arms.
Are you happy, Verena?
Happy? Oh, Jeff, there never was such happiness on earth before. I just wish we could never leave here.
Perhaps we don't have to.
Oh, no, a man like you can't live apart from the world, Jeff. Oh, James Pemberton was up to the house today. What a fine man he is.
Yes, when I'm not here, he's in complete charge of Briarfield. It's unusual, I know, not to have a white overseer, but there isn't a better, most more competent man anywhere than James Pemberton.
Well, everything certainly appears to be in beautiful order.
I've always insisted that the Negroes get good treatment. Whenever there's anything wrong, I like to have them settle it themselves. I've shown them how to set up a jury and hold a trial with their own people as judges. I'm glad you like Pemberton. He's one of my best friends in the whole world. You know, he was given to me as a body servant after I graduated from West Point. We moved together into free territory, and James could have freed himself any time he desired, but he preferred to stay with me. He saved my life more than once during those army days.
Jeff, my grandmother always said that the founders of this country only allowed slavery in the first place because all sorts of compromises had to be made to get the government started. But she said they all expected it to die out. You believe that, Jeff?
Yes. It'll end slowly, though. It'll take a lot of time and preparation.
Well, why don't we teach our people to read and write?
My people have been learning to care for themselves through experience. If a man returns to me the value of a day's work, he can take the time for himself. Last year, one of my men earned a couple of $1,000 for himself running a small store.
Well, that's wonderful.
Every family here can keep garden plots and sell to me or anybody else on the river. Marina, progress must be made slowly and with infinite care. I believe that if you try to rush things too fast, you only breed disaster.
Come in.
Mr. Jeff, I'm sorry to disturb you, but I wondered if I could go over some figures with you.
Come in, James. Sit down. James, I was going over my will last night. I suppose you'll want your freedom if I die before you do.
Well, sir, if you pass away, I'd want to stay on and take care of Ms. Davis.
Oh, James, thank you.
But if anything happened to Miss Davis, I'd want to be free.
And that's how it'll be, James.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Thank you very much, sir.
I look back to those years now, and it's hard to say when the cloud first appeared on the horizon and what the actual events were that darkened and spread until it reached the north and south. Jeff was a vital man, intensely interested in his country's problems. I waited at home while he went out on political campaigns and on speaking tours. I waited and prayed for his safe return during the fearful, agonized days of the Mexican War. When at last he did come back, he was appointed to the Senate. We went to Washington, and there our first child died of the fever and was buried. Later, Jeff served as Secretary of the War under President Pierce, and when Pierce's term was over, Jeff re-entered the Senate again. I wrote letters for him, took down his speeches when he dictated them, lived for him, worshipped him. I remember once he stopped our carriage in front of the White House, gazed up at it. I remember the pride in his face as he looked.
See that building, Verena? That's the heart of the whole United States. The blood of the North, the South, the East, and the West is joined together there in one man. That building represents unity and strength. The unity and strength of the United States of America.
Exciting, isn't it, Jeff? Here in this city, you have your fingers to the pulse of the entire nation.
You see that flag? Looks mighty sweet up there, doesn't it?
Mm.
You know when it looks even sweeter?
When?
When you followed it into battle, as I have, and you see it at the close of the day, still high in the air, triumphant.
Yes, I remember my husband's face as he looked at the stars and stripes of the United States of America. And I remember his face another day. Another day, dark, discordant, when I sat beside the rail in the Senate for the last time and heard him speak from the floor.
Gentlemen of the Senate, my state has seceded. To maintain our rights, we must leave. My state's convinced that her constitutional rights will not be honored. Her safety requires that she provide elsewhere for their maintenance. This action is the same action that the American revolutionists took when they withdrew from a government that threatened destruction of their rights. I see around me men with whom I've long served. In some cases, there have been differences between us. If I've unwittingly injured any of you, I offer my apologies. It only remains for me to bid you a final farewell.
Here I am, Jeff. I came down so I could leave the building with you. There's the White House, the flag. Jeff, that isn't our flag anymore. Jeff, when you were fighting in the Mexican War, I'd stop sometimes and I'd look at that flag and I'd think, he's risking his life. But it's worth it, the loneliness and the waiting and even the risk as long as you're still up there above our heads. I felt the same way all through the nights that I prayed that my father would return during the War of 1812. Jeff, I'm sorry, but my head's going round in circles. And my heart. Oh, Jeff, I think my heart is broken.
Here, get in the carriage, dear.
My child is dead and sleeps within this city. I'll have to leave him here, alone, among enemies. Oh, Jeff, why couldn't they have settled it peacefully? Go back in there, talk to them, find the way. There must be a way.
Marina, they want me to be provisional president of the Confederate States.
President of the Confederacy?
Yes, Marina, president of the Confederacy. It's the last position in the world I want, but how can I refuse?
Well, then, we must hurry. We have much to do.
You're my wife. You will not fail me.
No, Jeff, I'll not fail you. But may God guide us and help us to find our way out of this darkness.
Marina.
went slowly through the streets of Richmond. I looked at my husband and thought of time and times passing and what it had meant to us. I thought of the children that had been born to us and lived to bless our union. I thought of happiness. I thought of grief. I thought of terror. I sat beside my husband, riding through the streets of Richmond, and I remembered music. I remembered music and the shrill whine of bullets and the roar of cannon. And what does a woman remember of war? I remember that the soldiers were young, and it seemed that they had a shining gallantry as they marched. Or was that because my tears shone between us as I watched them? I remember how death came and stood beside me as I read each casualty report, and how in the night the cold finger of fear would touch my heart and rouse me to walk the sleepless hours. I remember stopping my carriage to help a wounded soldier and the look of his life's blood on the green silk dress I was wearing. I remember glimpsing my husband through a half-open door, down on his knees, praying. And I remember dropping to my own knees and thinking, the northern men and women pray together too. Dear God, help us to find our way back to one another. I remember the slow-moving wagons, piled high with furniture, moving out of Richmond, and the long files of sad-faced men and women. I remember the harsh lines of hunger in those faces and the hopelessness of their shoulders. I remember how, as the war reports came in, adoration gradually chilled to cold hatred in the looks they turned on Jeff. And I remember how I gave birth to a child with the sound of distant cannon throbbing through my veins. What does a woman remember of war? I remember my husband's face, older each time I saw him, and at last, old. I remember the tragic finality of the word Gettysburg, and joining with my children the stream of people fleeing south. And I remember Jeff riding up and joining us one night when we had pitched our tents. I was alone in mine when he walked in.
Verena, oh, my sweet, my love, Verena, thank God you and the children are safe.
Jeff, I'm so happy to see you, but you shouldn't be here if the federal troops capture you.
They capture me. At least I'll have seen you once again.
Jeff, I've seen the posters. President Johnson has offered $100,000 reward for your capture.
Yes, they're claiming I helped plot the assassination of Lincoln.
Dare they say a thing like that?
Verena, there's something I want you to tell our children. I may be captured. I may not be able to say this for myself. Tell them when they're old enough to understand that they'll hear many things said of me and of the men who fought beside me. But this, their father wanted them to know. We were not traitors. We fought honestly and bravely for what we believed in. Right or wrong, we fought in defense of our own principles. We lost, but we lost with honor.
You're speaking as though your own life were over.
To the victor belongs the spoils. Since I don't come under the former category, I must come under the latter.
I remember standing with our children in a cold gray dawn. I remember the soldiers lined up behind Jeff and the tug waiting at the wharf to take him from us. His face was gaunt as he embraced us, and a raw, discouraged wind sighed disconsolately about us.
Mother, don't let him take Papa. Don't let him take him. Please don't let him take him.
Don't, son. Don't let him see you cry. Your sister and brother aren't crying.
Oh, Jeff.
I love you all. I'll always love you. Come, Mr. Davis. Goodbye.
God keep you.
Papa! Papa! Papa!
And so began 2 years of worry, of prayers, of striving in every way I could devise to get my husband set free, or at least brought to trial so he could answer the charges brought against him. Most of the people in the South seemed to hate him. At times, I seemed to be fighting completely alone. I wrote letters. I gathered information in Jeff's defense. I hired attorneys.
Mrs. Davis, I have written repeatedly to the authorities, as you know, about Mr. Davis. All the satisfaction I've been able to get is that the case is under advisement.
But they can't hold him on the basis that he was involved in the assassination any longer. The men who testified that he was have admitted they lied. That's public knowledge.
Mrs. Davis, I have one suggestion for you.
What is that?
Go north for help.
Go north?
If men like Horace Greeley would step behind you, I think you could get your husband freed. Greeley's one of the most powerful newspaper men in the country.
But Greeley was Jeff's enemy. How could I go to him?
Greeley is a champion of justice, Mrs. Davis. It's worth a try.
Mr. Greeley, I'm very grateful to you for consenting to see me.
Sit down, Mrs. Davis. Now, tell me about your husband.
I saw him in prison a few weeks ago. He sits there day after day, night after night, and in a small, damp cell, just waiting. The people who once loved him seem to have forsaken him. Those who swore to remember have long since forgotten. Why is he being held? Is he alone to be held responsible for the war?
No. That cannot be. It must not be. No one man was responsible for the war. This war was like a quarrel in a family, in which brothers, in a flare of anger, lose their tempers and exchange blows. And now the quarrel is over, and the brothers are at peace, and the family is together again. Bitterness must be put aside. Anger must be forgotten. The family is the important thing. It must go on. How can I serve you, Mrs. Davis?
I have an application for his release. I've been getting signatures of northern men.
May I see the list?
Of course.
Mm-hmm. Here is the testimony of exactly what I've been saying, Mrs. Davis. You have here the signatures of men who were among the most bitter opponents of slavery. Here, written by their own hands, are the names of Jefferson Davis's enemies asking that he be set free. I shall be honored to add my own name to that list.
And so at last, 2 years after Jeff had been imprisoned in Fortress Monroe, we rode together through the streets of Richmond. And now he was free, and I looked up at him, and the tears burned my eyes, and he smiled at me in the old remembered way.
There's the hotel down the street.
Jeff, look at those people in front of it. It's a mob. Oh, Jeff, let's turn the carriage around and go in the hotel the back way. I don't think I can bear it if...
These are my people, Verena. Whatever they have to say to me, I must hear.
But these people are bitter. You don't realize, Jeff. I don't want you hurt anymore. You've been hurt enough.
My people, whatever they have to say, I must hear, Verena.
Oh, they're so still and not making a sound, Jeff.
Come, Verena. Let me help you out of the carriage.
Yes, of course, my dear.
Hats off, Virginians! Hats off to Jeff Davis!
Hats off, home, Jeff! Welcome home!
Men stood bareheaded facing us, and arm in arm with their welcome roaring in our ears, we walked between them, and the tears ran down my face, unheeded. We were home. The long war of grief and pain was over. The flag of stars and stripes was our flag, and once more we were a United States of America, and I found myself praying. Thank God for teaching us the meaning of the word united. Thank God that the family's together again and that there's peace between the brothers.
The Hallmark Playhouse, on Tuned to Yesterday from November 10th, 1949 on CBS. You're listening to an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now, an episode of Inheritance, overseen by NBC's staff director, Daniel Sutter. You might recognize that name if you're a sci-fi fan, as he directed most of the episodes of the X-1 sci-fi show on the network, a duty he would pick up months after this next episode, first heard on March 20th, 1955, called The Burning of Washington.
To be prepared for war is one of the most effective ways of preserving peace.
George Washington said it in his address to Congress, January 8, 1790. And the assembled legislators applauded and nodded in complete agreement and promptly forgot the president's words in the press of more ordinary business. It would be 24 years before Congress would remember them again. And on that day, they would be reminded by an unforgettable sight, by the smoking ruins of the Capitol itself. August 24th, 1814. The Burning of Washington.
This is Inheritance, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with the American Legion. Stories out of the great fabric of the American past. Stories of our inheritance.
A nation's heritage is made of many things, of visions, dreams, brave moments, and great achievements. It is also made of mistakes and failures, the kind that patriotic orators prefer to forget on the 4th of July. And yet sometimes the memory of those mistakes can be as valuable as that of our proudest traditions. For unless a nation is willing to learn and profit from the errors of the past, it may not long survive. It was August 18th of 1814, and the city of Washington drowsed in the discomfort of a typically hot, humid August day. The nation was entering the third year of its second war against Great Britain. A British fleet under Admiral Cockburn was still blockading and bombarding the shores of Chesapeake Bay. But there was hardly a soldier to be seen on the streets of the nation's capital. And the citizens went their way unconcerned with anything more important than the weather. A pig rolled in a mud hole on Pennsylvania Avenue. All was quiet along the Potomac. As a weary dispatch rider galloped into town, past the printing shop of Gales and Seton, where the newspaper called the National Intelligencer was published.
Man's a fool to flog his horse on a day like this.
Must be carrying dispatches for the War Department. Perhaps I better go down there and see what's up.
Oh, hold up there now. Wait till we got the paper set up in the press. Now, what was that last paragraph about Cockburn again?
If he should dare set foot on sacred American soil, rest assured that an aroused citizenry will spring to arms and singe the coattails of that cowardly, cringing cockatoo, Admiral Cockburn.
Oh, wait a minute. You can't say that.
Why not? Sir, are you standing up for that rascal Cockburn?
Oh, but you still can't say cringing, cowardly, cockatoo Cockburn. We haven't got that many C's left in the typecase.
Farther down the street, a galloping horse passed the government patent office, where Dr. Thornton was listening patiently, if wearily, to an inventor with an idea for driving the Royal Navy from Chesapeake Bay, something to do with training a new breed of barnacles to eat the bottoms out of British boats. Up at one end of Pennsylvania Avenue, Dolly Madison, the president's wife, was planning a dinner party with the aid of John Sousa, the White House steward.
And we will need service for 40. That is, if the French minister comes. Oh, poor man. Now that Bonaparte has abdicated, I suppose he hardly knows where he stands.
Oui, madame. Will we use the heavy silver plate?
Of course, and see that it's well polished.
Très bien, madame.
Oh, dear. So much to do before Wednesday night. I do hope it doesn't rain that night. It would be a pity if anything spoiled the party.
Meanwhile, at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, Representative Stewart was rising to query a meeting of the House Committee on Military Affairs.
Sir, I have received a private intelligence from Maryland that a British fleet of 22 sail has just been sighted in the Chesapeake, en route to join Admiral Cockburn's forces off the Patuxent River. Now, may I ask if the Honorable Chairman has had any official confirmation of this news?
We have no such word.
Well, I have reason to believe the information is accurate. And if this is true, such reinforcement can have only one meaning. The landing of an invasion force to strike at Baltimore or at the capital city itself. I ask again if we have made sufficient preparation to meet an invader.
We have been over this before, Mr. Stewart. In any such event, the President has authorized and Congress has approved a proclamation calling up 92,500 militia to the colors.
Where are they, then? Your 92,000 troops exist only on paper. The men are at home. The regiments aren't formed. You can't fight off an invasion with paper. I suggest that we call upon the Secretary of War to embody the militia of the district immediately and begin the distribution of arms.
I do not think it necessary for the committee to presume to tell the Secretary what his duty is. At your own request, Mr. Stewart, we made investigation into his preparations only a month ago. And to refresh your memory, I will read the conclusion of our report. That we have examined into the state of preparedness, naval and military, made to receive the enemy, and are satisfied that the preparation is in every respect adequate to the emergency, and that no measures are necessary on the part of the House to make it more complete. The meeting is adjourned.
At the War Department, the Secretary himself suddenly was feeling a little less confident of his own preparations. When the weary dispatch rider brought official news that the reinforced British fleet had entered the Patuxent River, Secretary Armstrong hastily conferred with General William Winder, in command of the defense of the area, and General Van Ness of the District of Columbia Militia.
22 sail, Mr. Secretary, and most of them troop ships. That can mean only that they're planning to strike somewhere, either here or at Annapolis.
Oh, yes. By God, they wouldn't come with such a fleet without meaning to strike somewhere. Ah, but my dear Winder, they certainly will not come here. Now, what the devil would they do here?
They'll hit at Annapolis, then.
No. Baltimore is the place. It's of so much more consequence.
How do you know they won't strike here?
Oh, come now, General Van Ness. We're a 60-mile march from the mouth of the Patuxent. They'd never dare that long a march through hostile country.
Still, it might be a possibility.
Well, Winder, whether they come here or not, it's your responsibility. We must be ready to defend ourselves.
Defend with what, Mr. Secretary? The militia that was guarding the Patuxent was disbanded by order of the War Department. For months I have been pleading that we call up at least 4,000 men so that we could give them a little training.
Now, see here,
in the
Winder,
whole
I...
District of Columbia, there is not a single point fortified. Not a redoubt, dike, or ditch, not a solitary piece of artillery, not a single battalion of regular soldiers, not one company of militia or volunteers properly armed, equipped, or disciplined. Now I ask you, sir, what am I to defend us with?
That is your problem, General Winder. I suggest you ask your uncle, the governor of Maryland. Perhaps he can supply you some troops.
So confused were the reports of the enemy's approach that James Monroe, the Secretary of State, rode out next day with an escort of dragoons to observe the British landing at Benedict. 4,500 soldiers of the king came ashore, looking like twice that number to the anxious watchers. And the British advance began. No one knew what the British target would be. And least of all, Rear Admiral Sir George Cockburn, who'd not yet made up his mind that he would like to dine on Sunday at the White House. But the mere possibility was enough to spread panic in Washington. Women and children began to flee the city, but not a cart nor wagon could be hired for love or money. All had been pressed into service for the military or for the removal of vital government records. On Tuesday, August 23rd, a ragged army of 3,000 volunteers marched out to Battalion Oldfields, spent all day waiting to repel the invader, and then, confused by their failure to appear, straggled back to Washington. Next day, the 24th, back they went again to meet the British at Bladensburg. For poor General Winder, it was not an auspicious day to begin a battle. The weather was oppressively hot, his men exhausted and untrained. The President and the Secretary of State and the Secretary of War were there and all giving conflicting orders. His best battalion of gunners under Commodore Barney were still stationed too far away, and his main source of reinforcement, Colonel Miner's regiment of militia from Virginia, was still back in Washington, beseeching an armory clerk to issue them guns.
195, 196, 197.
Come, get on with it, man.
Please, Colonel. Haste makes waste. Where was I? Oh yes. 197, 198, 199, 200. Very well now, sir, if you will sign here.
For what?
200 flintlocks and 200 muskets.
200? I've got nearly 1,000 men outside who are waiting for arms.
I'm sorry, sir, but 200 is all that I'm allowed to issue on my own authority.
Confound it, man. There's a battle being fought at Bladensburg. How do you expect my troops to fight without guns?
Well, of course, if you would care to find my superiors and take it up with them.
Where are your superiors?
At the Battle of Bladensburg.
Oh, no, never mind. We'll just take the 200 flintlocks.
They're not so fast, Colonel. Remember, haste makes waste. I'll have to count them just once more to make sure there's been no mistake. 1, 2, 3.
By the time the recount was finished, it was already too late. At Bladensburg, the disciplined British troops had simply swung into line, fired a sharp volley or two, and watched all opposition promptly melt away. The volunteers defending Washington collapsed into a disorderly retreat, leaving only 10 dead and 30 wounded behind. By 4 o'clock in the afternoon, some of them already were straggling back into town in groups of 3 or 4. No longer an army, but a disorganized rabble. The panic was on. There was no hope now of saving the capital. At the White House, the silver plate for the dinner party Dolly Madison had planned was all packed in a wagon, along with other valuables. But Dolly still lingered on, reluctant to go.
Polly, want a cracker? Nice, Polly.
Nice, Polly.
Pretty Paul Parrot.
Please, Mrs. Madison, I implore you.
Yes, Mr. Carroll.
There is no more time to waste. You must fly to Virginia at once.
I'm waiting word of my husband.
I assure you he will be safe. He is in the care of Graham's dragoons.
Very well. I was to wait for him here.
Oh, but, madam, he may not be able to return this way. The British may have cut off all the roads by now. I beg of you. If you will not think of your personal safety, then remember that you are the wife of the president. What a feather in Cockburn's cap if you allow yourself to be captured. It is your duty to go to Virginia at once.
Oh, dear, I... Oh, very well, Mr. Carroll, if you insist.
Oh, good. Susan.
Oui, monsieur.
Summon the carriage for madame.
Oui, monsieur.
Oh, come now, your coat.
Oh, no.
What is it?
Well, the Stuart portrait of George Washington. We can't leave that here for the British.
But you can't take that with you in the carriage. It's too large. The frame is too heavy.
Well, then we'll simply have to smash the frame. Susan, a hatchet, please.
Oh, please, Mrs. Madison, leave that to us. I promise you we will save the painting. Now, your carriage is waiting. You must leave at once.
Well, then. Oh, one more thing. The parrot.
Does madame wish to take the bird with her?
No. The poor dear doesn't like to travel. He suffers mal de mer in a carriage.
Oh,
Susan, you must find him a nice, safe home.
Oui, madame.
Ah!
Very good, madame.
Ah!
Goodbye, madame.
Bye!
At last, Mrs. Madison was gone. And so was the parrot. The faithful Sousa had taken him to the French ministry, and entrusted him into the tender care of the minister's cook. A little later, the weary president rode up to the White House, surrounded by his aides. A hasty council of war was held. It was agreed that all must flee before the British advance guard appeared. And quickly, Mr. Madison followed his wife across the bridge to Virginia and safety. At the Navy Yard and the armories, combustibles and powder trains were being laid. Orders were to burn or blow up all arms and munitions to prevent them falling into the hands of the enemy. At the arsenal at Greenleaf's Point...
Sir, we've just found 20 more kegs of powder.
There are no more wagons. You'll have to destroy it. Don't bother me, Pusey. There's no time to waste.
But, sir, there's that old dry well out back. Perhaps we could save the powder by hiding it there.
Well, maybe it's worth a chance. All right. Have the men put the powder in the bottom of the well. And let's hope the British don't get nosy or thirsty.
By 6 o'clock, when the British marched in, the sky was already filled with a fine red glare from fires set by the Americans themselves at the Navy Yard and the Armory. General Robert Ross, the British Army commander, came riding into town on a fine bay mare.
What a spectacle, eh, Major? What a sight to see.
Yes, sir. Well, they must have fired the whole naval yard. Oh, there goes a powder magazine now.
No. Well, they're saving us the trouble. You know, I thought we'd have more opposition than this. I haven't heard a shot fired. Oh!
General! General Ross, are you hurt?
No, I... What happened to my horse?
Someone took a shot at you from that house over there.
Oh. All right. Take a squad and find the man who did it. And then... burn down the house.
The troops moved on to the Capitol building, and in a holiday mood with hoots and jeers, fired a volley through the windows. And legend has it, though the story may not be true, that Admiral Cockburn, that tough old sea dog, mounted the speaker's rostrum in the house and signaled for quiet.
Order! Order in the house! I will now put the following motion. Shall this harbor of Yankee democracy be burned? All for it will say aye.
Aye!
Very well. The motion is carried.
Quickly, the flames sprang up. A little later, Cockburn's column rolled down Pennsylvania Avenue to the deserted White House. The admiral did not stay for dinner, as he'd promised. Instead, he conducted a leisurely inspection and even picked up some souvenirs to take home. A cushion from Dolly Madison's chair, an old hat that her husband had left behind. Then the windows were smashed out. The lighted port fires set the curtains ablaze. And across the Potomac, where he had taken refuge, the president watched another bright red glow mount in the sky and wondered where his wife and his army had gone. By now, all of Washington was threatened by the fires set by both the British and the retreating Americans. But then, a summer shower came up, and the gentle rain that fell from heaven was enough to keep the fires from spreading. The British rested for the night and resumed their work of destruction in the morning. At the printing office of Gales and Seton, Admiral Cockburn was reading his latest press clippings from the National Intelligencer.
Cowardly, cringing cockatoo, eh? All right. Lay to it, lads. Let's show them what we think of their infernal ram.
Admiral Cockburn, sir.
Eh? What is it, Major Waters?
I have an American here to see you, sir.
American, eh? What's he doing here?
He isn't connected with this blasted intelligence, is he?
Oh, no, sir. I'm Dr. Thornton of the Government Patent Office.
Well, come speak up. What is it you want, sir?
Admiral, I've heard that you plan to burn the patent office. I've come to beg you not to do it.
No? And why shouldn't I?
It would serve no military purpose, sir. I ask you to spare it in the interests of science.
No. Oh, well, there's no point in being too barbaric about it. Very well, Major Waters. See to it that the patent office is spared, and inform the troops that hereafter we will confine the burning to military installations.
Thank you, sir.
There's one satisfaction I will not be cheated of. All right, lads, let's finish this job and destroy every sea you can find in the type case. Sink me if this blasted rag ever abuses the name of Cockburn again.
The burning of barracks and military installations went on. 200 British soldiers marched out to the arsenal at Greenleaf's Point and finished putting it to the torch.
Ah, jolly good, Sergeant. A very fine blaze. Oh, there's nothing more to be done here. Form the men up and move on.
Aye, sir.
You better douse your port fire in that well. You won't be needing it any longer.
Oh, yes, sir. All right, Smith. Drop it in.
The lighted port fire dropped down the well was the first mistake the British had made. For the well was not only dry, but packed with the hidden kegs of powder. When the explosion had cleared, 10 men lay dead and 50 wounded. More casualties by an ironic chance than the British forces had suffered in capturing the city. The elements also began to conspire against them. The sky darkened. Suddenly, a rain and windstorm of hurricane velocity whipped over Washington, sending rooftops sailing through the sky, drenching the fires and the ardor of the British. As night grew on and the storm grew worse, General Ross and Admiral Cockburn conferred.
Well, General?
Sir, I think it's time we retired. We're outnumbered here. There's been enemy cavalry reported beyond Georgetown. And we're 50 miles from our supporting fleet.
That's true enough.
It's only a matter of time till the Yankees rally. I say, better withdraw now while we have the darkness and the storm to cover us.
Well, we've done everything we set out to do. All right, call in your pickets and sound the retreat.
The burning of Washington was over, and the city had been saved, not by arms or valor, but by the lucky chance of a summer rain. The British column marched back again with banners flying, and without even a musket shot to speed it on its way. It had been a truly extraordinary military feat of arms, and one that astonished the world as much as it humiliated America. For who could have believed that an army of only 4,500 men could invade a hostile nation of 10 million souls, penetrate its heartland for 60 miles without artillery or cavalry support, capture and burn the capital, and escape with hardly a scratch. But the feat was made possible not only by British daring, but also by American carelessness of almost comic opera proportions, by total unpreparedness, by our own disregard of George Washington's advice.
To be prepared for war is one of the most effective means of preserving the peace.
It was not the first time we forgot, nor would it be the last. From that day to this, right up to Pearl Harbor, America has somehow survived the habit of entering each new war still unprepared. But what about the next one, if there should be a next? The world has changed, and so has war, and neither one for the better. War no longer comes with ample warning, and there is no reprieve for the burning city in the gentle fall of a radioactive rain.
have been listening to Inheritance, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with the American Legion. Next week, Inheritance will take you on another journey through the pages of American history. Today's story was written by Dorothea Harris. Included in the cast were John McGovern, Matt Crowley, Richard Newton, Ronald Long, Alan Bergman, Ed Jerome, John Larkin, Richard Hamilton, Leon Janney, John Arison, and Ann Seymour. Norman Rose was the narrator. The music was composed and conducted by Roy Shield. This is Roger Bowman speaking.
Inheritance on Tuned to Yesterday from March 20th, 1955 on NBC. And that closes this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from the golden age of radio. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.